Chapter 45. Seemed to him now that he had judged her harshly in the first months of their marriage. He had felt a momentary impatience when he had tried to force her roving impulses into the line of his own endeavor. It was easier to view her leniently now that S.E. had almost passed out of his life. He wondered why S.E. had sent for him. Some dispute with her household, doubtless. A quarrel with a servant, even or perhaps some sort of difficulty with her creditors. But she began in a new key. "Your Highness," she said, "is not given to taking my advice." Odo looked at her in surprise. "The opportunity is not often accorded me," he replied with a smile. Maria Clementina made an impatient gesture, then her face softened. Contradictory emotions flitted over it like the reflections cast by a hurrying sky. She came close to him, and then drew away, and seated herself in the high back chair, where S.E. had throned, when he first saw her. Suddenly she blushed and began to speak. "Once," she said in a low, almost inaudible voice, "I was able to give your Highness warning of an impending danger." She paused and her eyes rested full on Odo. He felt his color rise as he returned her gaze. It was her first allusion to the past. He had supposed as he had forgotten. For a moment he remained awkwardly silent. "Do you remember?" she asked. "I remember. The danger was a grave one. Your Highness may recall that, but for my warning you would not have been advised of it." "I remember," he said again. She paused a moment. "The danger," she repeated, "was a grave one, but it threatened only your Highness's person." "Your Highness listened to me then. Will you listen again, if I advise you of a greater a peril threatening, not only your person but your throne?" Odo smiled. He could guess now what was coming. As he had been drilled to act as the mouthpiece of the opposition. He composed his features and said quietly, "These are grave words, madam. I know of no such peril, but I am always ready to listen to your Highness." His smile had betrayed him, and a quick flame of anger passed over her face. "Why should you listen to me, since you never heed what I say?" "Your Highness has just reminded me that I did so once, she repeated bitterly. "You were younger then and so was I." She glanced at herself in the mirror with a dissatisfied laugh. Something in her look and movement touched the springs of compassion. "Try me again," he said gently. If I am older, perhaps I am also wiser, and therefore even more willing to be guided." "We all knew that." She broke off, as though she felt her mistake, and wished to make a fresh beginning. Again her face was full of fluctuating meaning, and he saw, beneath its shallow surface, the eddy of incoherent impulses. When she spoke, it was with a noble gravity. "Your Highness," she said, "does not take me into your counsels, but it is no secret at court and in the town that you have in contemplation a grave political measure." "I have made no secret of it," he replied. "Nor I should be the last to know it," she exclaimed, with one of her sudden lapses into petulance. Odo made no reply. Her futility was beginning to weary him. She saw it and again attempted an impersonal dignity of manner. "It has been your Highness's choice," she said, "to exclude me from public affairs. Perhaps I was not fitted by education or intelligence to share in the cares of government. Your Highness will at least bear witness that I have scrupulously respected your decision and have never attempted to intrude upon your counsels." Odo bowed. It would have been useless to remind her that he had sought her help and failed to obtain it. "I have accepted my position," she continued. I have led the life to which it has pleased your Highness to restrict me. But I have not been able to detach my heart as well as my thoughts from your Highness's interests. I have not learned to be indifferent to your danger." Odo looked up quickly. She ceased to interest him when she spoke by the book, and he was impatient to make an end. "You spoke of danger before," he said. What danger?" "That of forcing on your subjects liberties which they do not desire." "Ah," said he thoughtfully. "That was all, then. What a poor tool she made. He marveled that, in all these years, Tresker's skillful hands should not have fashioned her to better purpose. Your Highness, he said, has reminded me that since our marriage you had lived withdrawn from public affairs. I will not pause to dispute by whose choice this has been. I will in turn merely remind Your Highness that such a life does not afford much opportunity of gauging public opinion. In spite of himself, a note of sarcasm had again crept into his voice, but to his surprise she did not seem to resent it. Ah, she exclaimed, with more feeling than as he had hitherto shown, you fancy that, because I am kept in ignorance of what you think, I am ignorant also of what others think of you. Believe me, she said, with a flash of insight that startled him, I know more of you than if we stood closer. But you mistake my purpose. I have not sent for you to force my counsels on you. I have no desire to appear ridiculous. I do not ask you to hear what I think of your course, but what others think of it. What others? The question did not disconcert her. Why your subjects? She said quickly. My subjects are of many classes. All are of one class in resenting this charter. I am told you intend to proclaim it within a few days. I entreat you at least to delay, to reconsider your course. Oh, believe me when I say you are in danger. Of what use to offer a crown to Our Lady, when you have it in your heart to slight her servants? But I will not speak of the clergy, since you despise them, nor of the nobles, since you ignore their claims. I will speak only of the people, in whose interest you profess to act. Believe me, in striking at the church you wound the poor. It is not their bodily welfare I mean, though heaven knows how many sources of bounty must now run dry. It is their faith you insult. First you turn them against their masters, then against their God. They may acclaim you for it now, but I tell you they will hate you for it in the end. She paused, flushed with the vehemence of her argument, and eager to press it farther. But her last words had touched an unexpected fiber in Odo. He looked at her with his unseeing visionary gaze. The end? He murmured. Who knows what the end will be? Do you still need to be told? She exclaimed. Must you always come to me to learn that you are in danger? If the state is in danger, the danger must be faced. The state exists for the people. If they do not need it, it has ceased to serve its purpose. She clasped her hands in an ecstasy of wonder. Oh, fool, madman, but it is not of the state I speak. It is you who are in danger, you, he raised his head with an impatient gesture. I? He said. I had thought you meant a graver peril. She looked at him in silence. Her pride met his and thrilled with it, and for a moment the two were one. Odo, she cried. She sank into a chair, and he went to her, and took her hand. Such fears are worthy neither of us, he said gravely. I am not ashamed of them, she said. Her hand clung to him, and she lifted her eyes to his face. Why you will listen to me? She whispered in a glow. He drew back chilled. If only as he had kept the feminine in abeyance. But sex was her only weapon. I have listened, he said quietly. And I thank you. But you will not be counseled? In the last issue one must be one's own counselor. Her face flamed. I if you were but that. She tossed back at him. The taunt struck him full. He knew that he should have let it lie, but he caught it up in spite of himself. Madam, he said. I should have appealed to our sovereign, not to her servant. She cried, dashing into the breach as he had made. He stood motionless, stunned almost. For what as he had said was true. He was no longer the sovereign. The rule had passed out of his hands. His silence frightened her. With an instinctive jealousy she saw that her words had started a train of thought in which as he had no part. She felt herself ignored, abandoned, and all her passions rushed to the defense of her wounded vanity. Oh, believe me, she cried, I speak as your duchess, not as your wife. That is a name in which I should never dream of appealing to you. I have ever stood apart from your private pleasures, as became a woman of my house. She faced him with a flash of the Austrian insolence. But when I see the state drifting, to ruin as the result of your caprice, when I see your own life endangered, your people turned against you, religion openly insulted, law and authority made the plaything of this false atheistical creature, that has robbed me of all, she broke off helplessly, and hid her face with a sob. Odo stood speechless, spellbound. He could not mistake what had happened. The woman had surged to the surface at last, the real woman, passionate, self-centered, undisciplined, but so piteous, after all, in this sudden subjection to the one tenderness that survived in her. She loved him, and was jealous of her rival. That was the instinct which had swept all others aside. At that moment she cared nothing for her safety or his. The state might perish, if they but fell together. It was the distance between them that maddened her. The tragic simplicity of the revelation left Odo silent. For a fantastic moment he yielded to the vision of what that waste power might have accomplished. Life seemed to him a confusion of roving force that met, only to crash in ruins. His silence drew her to her feet. She repossessed herself, throbbing but valiant. My fears for your highness's safety have led my speech astray. I have given your highness the warning it was my duty to give. Beyond that I had no thought of trespassing. And still Odo was silent. A dozen answers struggled to his lips, but they were checked by the stealing sense of duality that so often paralyzed his action. He had recovered his lucidity of vision, and his impulses faded before it like mist. He saw life again as it was, an incomplete and shabby business, a patchwork of torn and raveled effort. Everywhere the shears of Atropos were busy, and never could the cut threads be joined again. He took his wife's hand and bent over it ceremoniously. It lay in his like a stone. 4.8. The Jubilee of the Mountain Madonna fell on the Feast of the Purification. It was mid-November, but with a sky of June. The autumn rains had ceased for the moment, and fields and orchards glistened with the late verdure. Never had the faithful gathered in such numbers, to do honor to the wonder-working Virgin. A widespread resistance to the influences of free thought and Jansenism was pouring fresh life into the old formulas of devotion. Though many motives combined to strengthen this movement, it was still mainly a simple expression of loyalty to old ideals, an instinctive rallying around a threatened cause. It is the honest conviction underlying all great popular impulses that gives them their real strength. And in this case the thousands of pilgrims flocking on foot to the mountain shrine embodied a greater moral force than the powerful ecclesiastics at whose call they had gathered. The clergy themselves were come from all sides, while those that were unable to attend had sent costly gifts to the miraculous Virgin. The bishops of Mantua, Medina, Versailles and Cremona had traveled to Pianura in state, the people flocking out beyond the gates to welcome them. 4 mitred abbots, several monsignori, and priors, rectors, vicars general and canons innumerable rode in the procession, followed on foot by the humble army of parish priests, and by interminable confraternities of all orders. The approach of the great dignitaries was hailed with enthusiasm by the crowds lining the roads. Even the Bishop of Pianura, never popular with the people, received an unwonted measure of applause, and the white-cowled prior of the Dominicans, riding by stern and close-lipped as a monk of Zurbrunn's, was greeted with frenzied acclamations. The report that the bishop and the heads of the religious houses in Pianura were to set free suppers for the pilgrims had doubtless quickened this outburst of piety, yet it was perhaps chiefly due to the sense of coming peril that had gradually permeated the dim consciousness of the crowd. In the church, the glow of lights, the thrilling beauty of the music, and the glitter of the priestly vestments were blent in a melting harmony of sound and color. The shrine of the Madonna shone with unearthly radiance. Hundreds of candles formed an elongated nimbus about her hieratic figure, which was surmounted by the canopy of cloth of gold presented by the Duke of Medina. The bishops of Versailles and Cremona had offered a robe of silver brocade studded with coral and turquoises, the devout Princess Clotilda of Savoy an emerald necklace, the bishop of Pianura a marvelous veil of rose point made in a Flemish convent, while on the statue's brow rested the duke's jeweled diadem. The duke himself, seated in his tribune above the choir, observed the scene with a renewed appreciation of the church's unfailing dramatic instinct. At first he saw in the spectacle only this outer and symbolic side, of which the mere sensuous beauty had always deeply moved him, but as he watched the effect produced on the great throng filling the aisles, he began to see that this external splendor was but the veil before the sanctuary, and to realize what De Crucis meant when he spoke of the deep hold of the church upon the people. Every color, every gesture, every word and note of music that made up the texture of the gorgeous ceremonial might indeed seem part of a long-studied and astutely planned effect. Yet each had its root in some instinct of the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.